All right, so when we're diving into patent law and infringement pops up, it always seems to circle right back around to, well, the money, right?
Absolutely. It's pretty central, isn't it?
Yeah. And then you get this sort of like fork in the road where it's like, are we trying to figure out what the patent holder missed out on, those lost profits? Or is it more about, reasonable royalties? Like, what's a fair price for the infringer to essentially rent that invention? And like, for anybody working with law, especially our law student listeners, that difference is, it's so important to get.
Oh, for sure. The whole financial picture for someone with a patent totally hinges on which of those you can actually prove and win on in court, right? I mean, one is basically like making you whole for the sales you would had, and the other is, well, it's more like a general payment for someone using what they shouldn't have.
Right, exactly.
And as we're going to see, proving you lost specific profits, that bar is, it's set way higher.
Way higher.
That's where it gets super interesting.
It does. Which is the perfect, I think, segue into a case that is just crucial in this whole area. BIC Leisure Products v. Windsurfing International. This wasn't like your everyday patent fight.
Nope.
What the Federal Circuit did here with their decision, it was like they drew a super bright line. They basically laid down the law about what a patent owner absolutely has to show if they're coming after lost profits because someone infringed. It really reshaped how courts look at causation. Like that core element of, did this thing actually cause this other thing?
Yeah, when you glance at windsurfing initially, it does kind of seem open and shut. You've got they've got this patent on how they design their sailboard, and then BIC comes in, starts making and selling their own boards, which, legally speaking, we're definitely stepping on windsurfing's toes, right, on their intellectual property.
Totally, yeah. I mean, windsurfing had this patent and it was like a big deal at the time, innovative design. And here comes BIC basically saying, we're going to do our own thing. But that thing, it was infringing. So windsurfing took them to court, wanted damages. And initially, they actually won. They were awarded lost profits based on, the share of the market they already had, which BIC then entered.
And right there, that's where the Federal Circuit was like, hold on a sec. They asked this really important question. Could windsurfing just like wave their hands at their market dominance and say, those sales BIC made, those were totally going to be ours?
Like finders keepers, right?
Right.
Exactly.
But the court wasn't buying it.
They weren't convinced.
And it seems like logical at first glance, doesn't it? I mean, you have the patent, someone infringes, they sell a product that you also sell. Shouldn't those infringing sales be like a direct hit to your profits?
Seems straightforward, right?
But this case shows us that the court's thinking goes way beyond just who had what percentage of the market before.
Much deeper, yeah. Windsurfing had to show something much more direct. Like a real one-to-one connection, not just we were here first.
Definitely.
So it's not enough to just be like, we had this big chunk of the market. So any sale in that market that's infringing is automatically our lost profit.
Right. And that brings us to a super important point to think about, which is what was the market actually like? Were windsurfing and BIC truly going after the same customers head to head with the same kind of product?
And that's where things get really interesting because not even close.
Not at all.
Windsurfing their sailboards, they were selling for like $571 to $670. They were definitely positioning themselves as the more, the higher end brand, the premium option.
Yeah.
BIC. They were totally going for the like the entry level market.
Yeah.
Their boards were way cheaper, between $312 or $407. I mean, that's a huge difference.
It is. And, if we tie that back to basic economics and how people actually behave when they're buying things, prices, it's massive. It determines so much about who your customer is going to be. Someone who's out there specifically hunting for a bargain, like what BIC was offering, they might not even, consider that higher priced windsurfing board. It doesn't matter if the BIC one exists or not.
Like they're just not in the same mental space, right?
Exactly. They're looking at different value. They've got a different budget in mind.
And that's precisely what the court zeroed in on. It wasn't just about windsurfing having the patent and BIC messing up. The big question was, would those BIC customers, if BIC boards weren't around, would they have actually coughed up way more money for a windsurfing board?
Yeah, that's the key.
And with that huge price gap, the court was like, we're not so sure.
Skeptical.
So, okay, let's break down how the court actually thought this through, legally speaking.
All right. So when we're talking about trying to win back those lost profits in patent law, the Panduit test, that's like the gold standard.
Like the Holy Grail.
It's the set of rules that courts often use, right? It's got four main things a patent holder usually needs to prove.
Okay, first up, They got to show there was actually demand for what they patented, which here seems pretty straightforward, right? Yeah. People were buying sailboards. Both companies were selling them.
Yeah, no doubt about that. The fact that both Windsurfing and BIC were moving sailboards, that tells you there's a market. People want these things. But then you get to the second part of the Banduit test. And that's where this case, it takes a hard left turn. This is about whether there were other options, other substitutes that didn't infringe on the patent.
And this is where Windsurfing's whole, we had the market share, so those are our lost sales argument, starts to fall apart.
It does, yeah. It's like they were saying, we had a big piece of the pie, so any infringing sales within that pie, that's automatically profit we missed out on. But what's so interesting is how the court was like, nope, not so fast. They basically said, just because you had a big chunk of the overall sailboard market, that doesn't automatically mean there weren't other options for BIC's customers, especially when you look at that big price difference. You know, why would someone who's shopping on a budget suddenly be considered Windsurfing's lost customer just because one specific cheap option happened to be infringing?
Right. They might have bought something else entirely.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's two prongs of the Banduit test. What about the third one?
So that's about the patent owner's ability to actually meet the demand. Could they have produced enough to fulfill those extra sales if they had happened? In Windsurfing's case, it's pretty likely they could have scaled up production, right?
Yeah, probably.
And then the last part of the Banduit test, number four, is whether you can actually calculate how much profit the patent holder would have made on those supposedly lost sales.
But as we're seeing, everything really rests on that second factor, proving there weren't other good, non-infringing options out there. And like fundamentally showing that but for BIC doing what they did, those sales they made would have gone straight to Windsurfing.
Yeah, it all comes back to that but for.
And the Federal Circuit, they hammered this point home.
Yeah.
Just having a big market share, it's not enough to prove that but for causation, especially when the products aren't really direct competitors, you know, when the price and who they're targeting is different.
For sure. And getting into the Federal Circuit's reasoning is where this gets really fascinating. That price difference, like we were talking about Windsurfing being expensive, BIC being much cheaper, that was huge for the court.
It was like the deciding factor almost.
Pretty much. They basically saw those cheaper boards from BIC as like not even playing in the same league as Windsurfing's fancy products, not in the eyes of the customer anyway.
Like two different sports.
Exactly. Think about it. Like the market for those basic lower price sailboards, they probably had a whole different set of things that mattered to them, right? Price was probably a much bigger deal for those shoppers compared to someone looking at a higher-end board, like Windsurfing's.
Right, like different needs, different priorities.
Exactly. Someone who's got, say, $350 set aside for a sailboard, they might just not be willing or able to suddenly jump up to $600 or more, even if that cheaper option vanished.
Like their world just doesn't stretch that far, budget-wise.
Right. They might wait. They might find something else to do with their money. They might look for a different kind of cheap board. And that's a big point the court didn't miss. It wasn't just these two companies, Windsurfing and BIC, battling it out. The court specifically said there were at least 14 other companies selling sailboards while BIC was infringing. So even if BIC had never existed, no guarantee all their sales would have just magically gone to Windsurfing. Those customers, they might have happily gone with a different company that was offering similar prices.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. It's like more options means less certainty about where those customers would have gone.
Exactly. Windsurfing's argument for lost profits, it kind of relied on this idea that BIC's customers had nowhere else to go but to them if BIC wasn't there. But the court looked at the evidence, saw that price difference, saw all those other competitors, and they just weren't convinced.
That's why I am.
Especially when you had other sailboards out there priced closer to what BIC was offering. Windsurfing couldn't really say with certainty that BIC's customers were all just waiting to become their customers.
Okay, and on top of all that, there's something else that really jumps out at me here. Windsurfing was licensing their patented tech to other companies, companies who were also competing in the U.S. market. So how does that fit with their argument that there were no other decent, non-infringing options?
That's a sharp observation. The fact that Windsurfing was saying, hey, other companies, you can use our tech, that kind of weakened their whole claim that there were no good substitutes out there for customers.
It's like undermining their own argument a little bit.
A bit, yeah. Those licensees, they were offering sailboard designs that didn't infringe because, well, they had permission. This made it even harder for Windsurfing to draw that straight line between what BIC sold and what they supposedly lost.
So, like, more confusion, less certainty.
Right.
Okay, so let's wrap this up. What did the Federal Circuit actually decide?
They overturned the lower court's decision about those lost profits for windsurfing.
They said no.
They said no. Their main reason, windsurfing just hadn't proven that, but for BIC's infringement, those exact sales would have been theirs. Having a big slice of the market, it wasn't enough to prove that.
So, big lesson here. If you're going to go after lost profits in a patent case, you got to show that but for connection. You can't just assume the infringer's sales were automatically going to be yours, even if you're like the top dog in the market.
Exactly. Don't assume, prove, especially when it comes to how customers behave.
And that whole product differentiation thing, like windsurfing's premium boards versus BIC's entry-level ones, that price gap, it was central. The court basically said these companies weren't fighting over the same exact customers. The market for a cheap sailboard and a pricey one, they might be related, but they're also pretty separate.
Different worlds, and this loops back to the Panduit test, right? Sometimes having a big market share can be used as evidence that there aren't good substitutes, that second Panduit factor. But windsurfing shows us it's not a guaranteed thing, especially when you have prices that are miles apart and other companies in the mix offering stuff at all different price points. Market share alone just doesn't cut it.
You need more.
You need more. The court saw all those other sailboard options, especially the ones closer to BIC's price, and they were like, windsurfing, you can't say for sure that BIC's customers would pick you.
Too many what-ifs.
Too many what-ifs.
Now, there's this other part of the case, kind of the background, but still interesting intervening rights under, what is it, 35 U.S.C. Section 252. This comes up when a patent gets reissued, right?
Okay.
So what was the deal with BIC's inventory, the stuff they had before windsurfing's patent got reissued?
Okay, so this is a super cool and often forgotten part of patent law.
It's like a secret weapon.
Kinda. In windsurfing, the court actually said BIC had these things called absolute intervening rights. These rights protected the specific sailboards they had already bought or placed orders for before windsurfing's patent got reissued.
So they were in the clear for that stuff.
Exactly. This legal rule basically protects people who took certain steps related to the invention before the patent got updated. It means the patent holder can't come after them for damages related to those specific pre-reissue items. It's a way to limit how much the patent owner can claim, and it shows just how tricky things can get when patents go through this reissue process.
So putting it all together, what does windsurfing mean for how patent cases go down and how companies should think about damages? This case, it sends a pretty clear message, doesn't it?
Big time. What patent holders need to take away is this. If your product isn't a direct match for what the infringer's selling, especially when it comes to price and who they're targeting going hard after those lost profits, might be a lot harder and riskier than you think.
Like pick your battles.
Yeah, exactly. In those situations, focusing on proving what a reasonable royalty would be, that might be the smarter move, the safer bet. To get those lost profits, you absolutely have to show that but-for connection. And windsurfing proves that's tough, especially when the products are different.
No assumptions allowed.
No assumptions.
So with everything we've learned about how markets work and how customers think, thanks to windsurfing, it makes you wonder, how can patent owners in the future prove that but-for thing really strongly, especially in cases where the products aren't exactly identical? That's a tough question, with a lot riding on the answer for anyone who's dealing with patent law and going to court.
Absolutely.
It's a lot to think about.
It is.
All right, that's going to do it for our deep dive today. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.